Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us for another exciting podcast. I've got Sean and Dane with me today. Say something funny, you guys.
Oh, boy. Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Brilliant. That's good. Sean, we're relying on you. Make us laugh.
Yeah. Sorry, Lucas. No.
It is 8 a.m.
No, I can't do that. It's 8 a.m. I just dropped off my kids. We just had a big yelling match this morning.
Did you really?
The cats barfed everywhere. And,
oh, no.
There's a big argument about who's in charge of cleaning up the cat barf. Does that fall under the kitty litter job? I'm not in a laughing mood this morning. I'm still shell-shocked.
But you did make me laugh. That's pretty good. I mean, that's a question of departments. Is this janitorial or is this feeding? Because it is food, you know.
So it is
culinary regurgitation. So
there are three areas of responsibility that our kids have in our house. There is kitty litter is a responsibility. Dishes are a responsibility, and trash. And every kid gets a different job every week. So there's a big fight over. Well, Zane had kitty litter, but does barfing in the hallway fall under taking care of kitty litter?
Well, I can tell you one thing. The dish person is safe.
The dish person is safe.
Yes. Unless safe. They didn't wash the cat's dish well enough and they got salmonella, which is a
well, no, we have the cat water and that falls under kitty litter. So that's, you know, you can just think of it as cat. So you have to fill up the cat water. That was a whole other issue. Anyways, do you guys ever feel shell shocked after like parenting a hard morning?
Yes,
of parenting
Yeah.
I'm just
I had that this morning too.
Did you really? What happened with you?
Well, it wasn't as escalated as cat regurgitation, but it was I have a 1-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter, and anyways, we've been teaching Sadie how to, like, if she needs to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, she can go do that, and she doesn't need to wake us up to do it. She's does it and then tucks herself back in, and she's pretty good most of the time. She'll do it, and we've been doing kind of like a reward system for reinforcing, like, this is worth this new change, you know, type of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And anyway, so she did it twice last night, and her Mimi gave her a little piece of chocolate that she could have after lunch because of that or whatever. And so we're like, yeah, that's awesome. That's great. And then we bring Cooper out of his crib to sit at the table with us for breakfast this morning. And Sadie can sometimes, it can be a 50-50 on, like, how welcoming she is of her brother, because her emotions can fluctuate and wanting attention and mommy and daddy time and that sort of thing. Anyways, she was looking pretty distant from him, and anyways, we would try to tell her, like, no, like, you need to treat your brother with kindness. And anyways, she was just like, she gets all, like, quiet, and like the look on her face will say it all type of thing. And then so we're like, okay, well, I mean, if you're going to treat your brother like that, like, you're not going to be able to have that chocolate after lunch. And then she just goes into shutdown mode a little bit. And she's like, she'll say, I don't want it. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll put it over to the side. And then, so anyways, like, after all of that, like, she went to her room after she finished her breakfast to just, you know, think about stuff. And she came back. Well, when she was gone, I told Kay, man, I feel bad for taking her, you know, taking the chocolate away, because, and she's like, well, I mean, she can't treat her brother like that. And I'm like, I know, but this reward had nothing to do with that. And I'm like, I don't know. And anyway, so I was like, anyway, she's like, yeah, but still, like, we can't, like, allow her to be rewarded for bad behavior, that sort of thing. And anyways, what we ended up doing was, when she came back out, she basically, you know, we had her, like, make up with her brother and stuff or whatever, but we said that we did a little bit of a compromise thing where, if you you can have your chocolate, like, after lunch, but you can have half of it after lunch, and if you're kind to your brother this morning, you can have the whole thing. And and that way kind of preserve, like, you know, she's getting it for what she did last night, but if she, you know, does what she's like supposed to, or like treats her brother, you know, how she ought to treat him, then she can have the full thing. But anyways, it's just like,
you know what that shows? This is what, yeah, that whole story. You know what that shows to me? How laws multiply. You're making up these laws as a parent.
Yeah.
And it's like, you get a chocolate for going to the bathroom, but wait a second, you're not being nice to your brother. Well, that kind of cancels that. That's going to cancel that reward. And here's the new law that it's, and the religious life is just like that. And parenting is just like it's a microcosm of like law upon law upon law. And then your kids, they pick up on it, right? They're like, wait a second. You said life is this way, and now you're changing your mind. And where is this arbitrariness? And then you feel guilty as a parent, and you're like, ugh.
I felt the arbitrariness. And I'm like, oh, I feel bad because I'm like taking something that she takes. Yeah,
I'm clearly making this up as we go.
You know, one thing that I struggle with, and this is, I struggle with introducing grace into parenting, grace, mercy, compassion. Yeah. I find like the law comes pretty easy, especially if I'm angry. I can make up new laws on the spot.
Yeah.
I don't know. Why, sorry, Lucas, I interrupted you.
Oh, I was going to share one that, I mean, each of y'all shared one. I think I'll share one that sort of shows a bit of a failure on my part. I've been trying to do a Bible story each night before they go to bed. And there's like one cardinal law that thou shall not interrupt the story, you know. Uh-huh. Now this is true too if I'm just telling a story, I'll just sometimes make up stories, so it counts for that too, but it feels even more weighty when we're talking Bible stories. So I am trying to learn to just bulldoze through no matter what distractions are happening in the room, right? I mean, like I've been practicing at this for years, because used to I would stop and I would just be mad and like, you guys are interrupting. Don't interrupt. We're doing story time, you know, which I know sounds so silly, but it feels, and it's even more if I'm reading them something that I wrote. I get really upset if I'm reading something that I wrote for them. Like sometimes I do these dragon stories for them, and if they interrupt, I just punish them with my mood. I don't spank them or anything, but like my mood, I'm just like, fine, we're not doing it. We're not going to finish. You know, like we're one sentence from the end, and it's like, no, we're not going to. And then everybody's crying. I'm like, you know, it makes me mad when you cry at bedtime. You can't cry at bedtime. So the other day, we're reading through Mark. And, you know, we're reading about Jesus's compassion and patience for everybody. And my oldest, she interrupted, and she's very savvy to this. She knows that interruption, you only interrupt if it's pretty serious. And she said, Lux, the youngest, is naked. He's doing flips and he needs his bottom to be wiped. And he's like flipping around on the beds and his bottom needs to be wiped. And I just stared her down. I mean, cause that is a legitimate reason to interrupt a story. You know, that's like, but I didn't, it took me a minute to recognize that, like, okay, this is a legitimate reason. So I stared her down with a pretty angry face because I thought she was just interrupting because I was already trying to ignore that. Well, I said, no, okay, fine, we'll be done with our story. And I just closed it. And then she disappeared. And a little bit later, I kind of circled the house and I realized, oh, she's in the bathroom. And I came to the door and I said, Eily, are you in there crying? And she said, well, I'm getting ready for bed too. It's like, okay, but you are crying. I mean, and she's like, yeah. So she came out and, you know, and it's like a failure and a success. The success is usually what happens after the failure. It's like, I do think these failures are opportunities for them to see, how do we clean up a mess? You know, do we throw a fit and then just live in the mess of the fit? Or do we calm down and talk about it? And so that's what we did, and it was fine by the end of it. But man, like bedtime has been pretty good for us for a long time. But when it's bad, it's really bad. You know, it's like I'm upset and I'm slamming the doors and stuff like that. So each of us has shared a story. I think listeners can kind of get a sense of the age of our kids. But why don't we go through and talk about the age of our kids, and then we're going to jump into what we normally get told as parents, as Christian parents, and then we'll talk a little bit about kind of grace parenting, which just randomly, Sean, I don't know if you had that story planned about the cat or if it just lined up, but But thanks for having a terrible morning with your kids so that we could have like a really great intro.
You're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
So well done. Sean, why don't you start? Tell us the age of your kids. You can leave out their names just for anonymity, but what are their ages?
Oh, I don't know. I talk about them all the time.
Okay, well, that's fine too.
Daphne's 13. Zane is going to be 12 in just a few weeks, and Scout is 9.
Okay, so you are in the teenage years with two more moving into teenagerism before too long.
Yeah.
So I'm the next slot down. Our oldest is 11, and our youngest is a little older than 2, I think. Yeah, that feels about right. He's just kind of coming into the potty trained phase. So what would that make him? That's probably about 2, I think. And then we've got 2 in between, so we have 4 in all. Dane, what are the ages of yours?
Yeah. Sadie, my oldest, she's 3. She'll be 4 this year. And then Cooper, he just turned 1. So,
yeah. Okay.
We're in the beginning stages over here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fitting because we're all at different stages and we're thinking about different things. And so throughout this conversation, that probably will bear out that each of us kind of has a different focus. It's the same continuity process, but it's like you're focused on different emphasis at different ages. So Sean, a minute ago before we started, well, actually both you and Dane, y'all mentioned something that I didn't really think about. I had put together a list of common parenting verses, and you guys both noticed something about it that I didn't really think much about. So why don't you kind of repeat that idea about law? Give us that sense of what the common verses are and how they fit into law, and maybe a little bit of a description of the difference between that and what we're aiming for.
Well, Lucas, you sent out a list of verses that maybe could be the foundation for our discussion. And there were verses like that we all know, like in Proverbs 22:6, start a child on the way he should go, and even when he's an old man, he won't turn from it. Or Colossians 3:21, fathers, do not embitter your children or they'll become discouraged. Or Proverbs 13, whoever spares the rod hates their children, but the one who loves their children is careful to discipline them. And then, like, for just one example from the child's responsibility side, honor your father and mother so that you may live long in the land. And what struck me about that list was, yeah, those are all duties. Those are all duties and responsibilities. Those are commands. Those are all law. But I was like, where in this list are kind of the grace passages, the mercy passages, there's another side to it. This is kind of the moralistic demand side, but there's another side. And Dane, you had the same thought, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. What struck me was when Lucas because he sent this list ahead of time, because we were planning on doing this a little while back and haven't up until now. But I was chatting with my wife, Katie, this morning about it. And I'm like, these verses are like, they're true and like, they're good, but they never come to my mind whenever I'm trying to practically parent. Because they're like, yeah, they're true statements with, you know, real like benefits to them if you do them. But what I'm trying to think of, like, yeah, if I tell my child, you know, obey your or honor your parents because this pleases the Lord. Like, I mean, it's true, but it also feels like there's nothing that empowers them to accomplish that, or it just feels like, yeah, a list of things. What I've found my default typically is when I'm parenting, and usually it's kind of like after the failure, like when Lucas says, like, it's like success comes after the failure type of thing. It's like, depending on how I dealt with the situation, my mind always goes to, is that how God would have dealt with me for doing something?
Yeah, that's good.
And was that like proportionate to what they actually did? And, you know, was it just mean? Was I fair? Was I like, so that typically is my default, is thinking about the character of God and the history of his actions towards people for things that they did or didn't do. And like, trying to see patterns in how God, you know, graciously deals with people when they either mess up or, you know, disobey and that sort of thing. So the list is true, but it's not really what I think about whenever I'm trying to parent.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good. I wonder, so you use the term proportionate. I was thinking about like proportionate responses is what you think about in wartime. You know, when you're at war, you think about, well, they blew up two of our buildings, so we're going to blow up two of their buildings, you know. And if you parent that way, then you are allowing you hopefully it's the child that's less mature. You're allowing the child to dictate how you proportionately respond to their, you know, to their immaturity. And so you can get into this cycle where you're actually using immaturity as a parent to just shape the behaviors of the child to be, it's sort of like, I'm going to out crazy the crazy. I'm going to outrage the rageaholic. I'm going to out scream the screamer. And I find myself doing that enough to notice that it's a problem. Like, okay, they're screaming, so then I scream at them not to scream. I mean, like, a proportionate response. It is proportionate, but it's not good. It doesn't follow grace, you know. And it's also not creative, which I think maybe bugs me as much as anything else, is like, it's so bland to just do what they're doing. Like, let's do something that's surprising in its grace. And Sean, I think you have a story that I've heard you tell once or twice before that I think would be great to put here. The story of surprising grace, your son with grace. Can you kind of remind us of that? Some might have heard it already, but I think
it's something I've tried a couple times, but the first time I tried it was, I don't want to give away too many details, but it involved Zane, and Zane had been caught doing something he should not have been doing. And like any kid, his first reaction to being faced with the accusation is, I didn't do it. You know, what are you talking about? I didn't do it. And just lie and cover up and try to hide. And then that just leads to, we had just learned, you know, that just leads into another fighting match. Yes, you did do it. No, I didn't. Well, here's the da-da. Well, I didn't do that. Blah, blah, blah. And that particular day, I was just so tired. I was just tired of the fighting. I was tired of being angry and fighting. And so I went to him and I said, son, I just want you to know that you are already forgiven. You're already forgiven of this thing. If you did it, you're already I'm not angry. There's no consequences. You are already forgiven. Now, did you do this? And he was really taken aback and completely disarmed. And I remember he just started bawling. He just started crying. And he confessed that he had done the thing. And it was just a moment of just assurance of pardon, you know, just forgiveness. And we talked about it, and I was like giving myself a high five because I was like, that was a parenting high five, Sean. Good job.
Yeah.
And I've tried that on other occasions, but to be totally honest, that doesn't always work.
Yeah.
But in that moment it worked very powerfully. But you know what? God's grace doesn't always work. God shows grace to the whole world, but not everyone responds to that grace. But when people do, it's really impactful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a story I haven't heard. That is not the one I was thinking of, but that was
Oh, really?
the one, I don't want to give away the details, but how can I signal to you what I'm talking about? Because that was really that it's in the same family. You took Zane somewhere unexpectedly is the story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that one, yes. About.
Which I think maybe was the genesis of this. I mean, I don't know. Yes. Was that the beginning?
Okay,
can you tell that one?
Yeah. So for that one, Zane has always been a picky eater. And I remember, is it the eating story?
Seems like. I don't remember the details. I just remember
this could be almost any night. Like last night we were arguing about food. So Zane is a picky eater, and he was throwing, especially when he was young, just throw a fit. He doesn't want to eat. But when he doesn't eat, he throws fits. And so we're like, you need to eat because this is why you're throwing a fit. But how do you argue with a five-year-old? Anyways. Usually we would, Abby and I, you know, we would just kind of spank him, or the threats would get higher and higher and the consequences would get higher and higher. But that night I decided to try something different, and I was so angry, and Zane is on the floor crying. He's probably like 5 or 6 years old, refusing to eat a supper. And I said, that's it. And I slammed the table and I said, we are going to Burger King. And he's like, what? Kind of like, what? It's like, that's it. Get your coat. We're going to actually use Wendy's. Get your coat. We're going to Wendy's. If you don't want to eat supper, we're going to Wendy's. And he was just so shocked. And so everyone was shocked. I was shocked at myself for coming up with this idea. So we get into our car and we drive to Wendy's, and he's just quiet, just absolute quiet. And he doesn't believe it that we're actually good. He refused to eat supper, and he's going to go to Wendy's instead. And we went to Wendy's and we got the burger and we sat down. And it was, he just apologized. So that was another moment where he was just like, he's eating his burger and he's like, I'm really sorry, Dad. I'm sorry for throwing a fit. And I was like, you know, this unexpected mercy is what actually maybe changed his heart a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and didn't, in the first time I heard you tell the story, it seemed like you had some kind of conversation with him about what are you experiencing right now? And didn't he identify it as like, this is grace or something like that?
Yeah, you're right. Familiar? Yeah, yes, that's right. That's right. Thank you for remembering that. Yeah, I'll ask them, and I'll do this also with allowance. You know, our kids get $20 a month, and some months they lose their entire allowance, you know, but then at the end of the month, I'll just be like, here's your $20. What is this? What do you call this? And I just want to hear them. I want to help them make the connection to real life, you know, and they're like, this is grace. And I was like, yes.
Oh, because they know that they technically had lost.
They lost it.
Yeah.
So to get the $20 even so that, but just to help them make that connection, not to make them grovel, but just to be like, do you understand? And then like, this is what Jesus does for us.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, does it need to be identified as grace to not be enabling, or is it in the frequency? Is it like how often you do that? Like if you do it, I mean, I don't know, like, because you might look at a parent who just overlooks all of a kid's bad behavior and say, well, that's not grace. That's just lazy. You know, they're not giving them grace. And maybe the difference is that you're actively giving them something at that moment rather than just saying, I'm going to overlook it. Like you were taking action.
Right,
it's just
right.
A surprising grace-filled action rather
than like there is such a thing as antinomianism. You know, there is such a thing as just being an anything goes parenting, and anything goes parenting is not grace. That's not what we're talking about. You know, there was a law that was broken and there was a consequence, but I, as the parent, am going to absorb that consequence and give you what you don't deserve anyways.
Yeah.
As opposed to just letting anything go.
I'm imagining that this concept would be a struggle for a lot of the parenting programs and a lot of the parenting books, because they really rest on a form of domineering legalism. Often it's the father is in charge, and the child needs to submit and come up under that, which I would say is a truth. There is a truth in that, but it's also not the whole story, you know? And so let's kind of experiment a little bit with that. Like, how have you seen legalism
play out in parenting, at, you know, parenting advice or parenting, if you've read parenting books or whatever, like how do you relate what we see to legalism?
I think a lot of times it comes with this list of verses that we
had,
and it at least from the things that I've heard or read, and it takes the form of the vibe of the parent is the authority, the child is living in, you know, the home that doesn't technically belong to them. It belongs to the parents, and therefore this it's like logical and like it's true, but it's also like, okay, but it seems more of like more strict, and it's like by the book, and like, no, like the kid doesn't get the say, the kid doesn't, you know, rule the roost, the parent is in charge type of deal, which which we all know, like, yes, like that's correct. But Sean made the point regarding like the grace thing, like it there's more to the story than just a one side thing. Like, yes, there has to be like structure and like an order, but it's not just here's your orders, now march, like I said. It's it's a relationship, and God doesn't just have us do things for the sake of doing them. Like, there's reasons behind it, because it's good for us, it's healthy for us. It's He desires for us to thrive, and He, like, unlike us, which I know often I'm like, I wish I, you know, had the foresight that God does, so I can, you know, properly deal with my kids. But He knows what is best for us, and He's built in the things that He desires for us to live like, to help us to thrive and benefit from those things. And when we don't, it's damaging to us. It's damaging to our fellowship or relationship with Him. And that ultimately, you know, domino effects into, you know, more unbeneficial things. And so, I think that a lot of parenting books often just, you know, like, you know, spare the rod, ruin the child type of thing.
Yeah. And that's like the favorite one. And
yeah. And so like, I think it does just flow through that, vein of, rule following, and I'm in charge, you're the kid, like, learn to deal with it type of thing.
I think a key part of legalism in religion, but also especially in family life, parenting, is like the value and the value of the child. It's like their feeling that you love them, their feeling that you accept them is made to be conditioned on how well they do in life, how well they perform. So it's like, it's almost like telling a kid, maybe unconsciously, very few parents would say that overtly, but just the kid internalizes this idea is that my approval depends upon my performance or my acceptance in this family, or, you know, it has happened before. In fact, it actually happened to me, where a parent will just say, just kind of cut you off. I mean, how many people have experienced their parents cutting them off, disowning them, rejecting them because of what they've done, how they've behaved, you know? You know, I think there might be a defense, you know, sometimes kids are just dangerous and they go into criminal lifestyles and parents just have to distance themselves, just like the maybe. But I'm talking about parents who tell their kids, you are not a Lazar unless you get straight A's, or unless you make this varsity team, or unless you get into this school. I do not value you. Your value depends upon meeting these benchmarks. That's another kind of aspect of legalism that I think happens in parenting a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and it's probably happening alongside all of this, you know, all of this stuff. Because what I was thinking is, an unbeliever could even follow most of these verses that we pulled up. The assumption is that
these verses go along with the context, which the context is it's they're for believers. They're for people that already are practicing grace and already are forgiving and you know, removing bitterness from their own lives. And then if you're in that context, then to say that, yes, occasionally, you know, you do probably need to have some boundaries and have some, you know, be strict on certain things, but you're doing that within the context of already being a grace-oriented person. But one of the problems, I think, is that those who have a mean streak or those who want to be domineering or those who want to be a dictator or a tyrant in their own home, they pull these verses out and they use them as proof that they're doing God's will, that they are acting on God's pattern. You know, but here's a thought I had that challenges that is that I wrote this down while one of you guys was talking. Grace requires pattern recognition. And what I mean by that is you do need to discipline at least once so they know what the expectation is. And then if you show grace against that pattern, then it stands out more. So like imagine the Old Testament, for instance. If God from the very beginning in the Garden of Eden said, hey, you know, you guys messed up. It's eternally egregious what you did, but I'm going to overlook it. And then he just always overlooked sin. Mm-hmm. Well, then how would we recognize grace? We wouldn't come to understand what the pattern is, what the expectation is. But instead, he spent, you know, millennia helping us to see what the expectation is so that when Jesus showed up, we could recognize that this is what we deserve. The law is a tutor, you know? And so I think we want to be careful in saying, we're not saying we throw out all these verses. We use these verses in a way, in a way similar to the way that God used the law to show the children of Israel what the expectation is. What life could be like if I fully pressed my right to discipline you, you know?
Yeah.
And then when we show grace in that context, then I think it can have the kind of effect that Sean, you shared with your son, is that they recognize what the expectation is. We usually scream and yell and I get a spanking and, you know, and all this stuff. And now I'm eating a Wendy's burger, you know, I mean, it's like, It's a huge shift. And so there is a place for these. There is a place for making those boundaries. But let's kind of transition into some verses maybe that could help us in grace, you know, in grace-oriented parenting. Dane, you kind of led off with this idea of like, what does your mind go to? And you talked about it a little bit, but let's expand on it. Like, what does your mind go to when you're trying to parent successfully? Like, what are some of those phrases that go through your mind, or how do you get yourself in the right place? And let's talk about the successes right now. We've talked about our failures. We got plenty of failures, but let's talk about those moments, like when it actually was like, man, this really worked. What does that look like for you?
Well, okay. So this, and I kind of thought of something when Sean was talking about how kids can often tie their value or their love from their parents to their performance. And what Katie and I have tried to do is to drill it into our kids' head. Well, Cooper's coming up. He doesn't really understand a ton at this point, being one. But Sadie, she's picking up on a lot of stuff. So we were trying to drill it into her head, like, mommy and daddy always love you all the time.
Yeah.
We love you.
Yeah. It's good.
What you do or don't do does not change that. And, and so whenever she does something that, where she messes up or she gets in trouble, she's the type of person that she shuts down, and doesn't, she just gets really quiet and she's like, her thing is like, I'm so tired. Like, I just want to sleep. Like, and she doesn't want, she just wants to hide, basically, kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of like Adam and Eve hid type of thing. Which is like, she messed up. She feels that. She knows that mommy and daddy, like, there's friction. Even if we're trying our best to, you know, show that we're not, you know, like we're not mad at her. We're just wanting her to understand like what she did or whatever. But yeah. What we always try to do is, we often tell her, even in moments of non-conflict, we're like, mommy, daddy, always love you. Like, and no matter what. And during those times where we're having a conversation with her, whenever she's trying to hide and stuff, like we try to talk to her calmly. And whenever, we sense that she's starting to, you know, be more talkative, we'll ask her the question, does mommy and daddy still love you? And, and sometimes she's a goofball and she's like, no. And I'm like, wait, what did you say? No, does mommy and daddy still love you? And then, we remind her, because a lot of times she'll say yes, and we'll say like, do we always love you? And she's like, yes. And then she'll say, even when I'm bad, like even when you're bad, we love you. That doesn't mean the things that you do, you know, make us happy or like please us all the time or whatever, but that it's doesn't like change
she,
we love you.
She is doing bad. You're not saying, oh, you're not really doing bad. No, you are doing bad, but we still love you. That's powerful.
Yeah, we try to divide that for her, and she gets it. She's told us often, like she'll even remind us, she's like, even when I'm bad, and we're like, that's right, even when you're bad, even though when you're doing things you know you shouldn't do, like that doesn't make mommy and daddy happy. She's three, and she's picking up on all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So that's, to me, I always tell people, like I'm telling my congregation that the structure of Christian living, grace living, is different from legalistic living. And I think, Dane, you're kind of pointing out one of the fundamentally different structure. In a legalistic structure, you behave to be accepted. Yeah. But in a grace structure, you are accepted. Therefore, therefore behave this way. We behave out of a place of loving acceptance. And
That's good.
There's a British show that I have started watching called Long Lost Family. It's with Davina McCall, and basically it's the premise of the show is that they reunite adoptees, parents who gave up children for adoption, children who were adopted, and reunite them with their family. And that's meaningful to me because all of these people kind of came out of the same era in England. And my dad was kind of one of these people who was separated from his mother and only got reunited with her in his 30s. Wow. And so I honestly cry every time, every episode. But because it's just so meaningful for the people to find their families. And one of the things that I hear over and over again, especially from the children when they're seeking their parents, was they were so afraid. Like, why did my parents reject me? Why didn't they want me? What did I do? And they live, even though all of them, most of them kind of grow up with very loving adopted families, they're haunted by this question. Why did my father or why did my mother reject me? And the catharsis comes, especially when a parent says, you know, I was like 15 when I had you and I had to give you up. I've thought of you every day and you have always been loved. And when a parent says you have always been loved, always been thought about, there's always a huge breaking point for the adopted person.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, that's what they've wanted to hear all this time. And I think in grace parenting, that's the final fundamental message we can give our kids, because that's the message we hear from God the Father. You are loved. You are fundamentally loved. No matter how much you screw up, you are fundamentally loved, accepted, and part of this family forever. And I think that just kind of changes. It should just change the game. Even as a pastor now, I see this a lot where there's a lot of people in my kind of, let's say, in my pastor, you might say, where they don't know who their dad is. They don't know who their mom is, or they haven't seen them in years. And it's a wound. It's just an open wound to not know that they were loved by their biological mom or dad. And in grace parenting, just like in the gospel, we are assured that God loves the world, which means you, which means whoever is listening, God loves you and sent his son to die for you, to rise again from the dead, to give you eternal life just by believing in him. And that should change parenting. I try to every once in a while, you know, I try to like, just like what Dane was saying, just assure my kids, listen, I love you. You're safe here. I'm not thrilled with your behavior right now. You're really exasperating me, but I still love you. Don't ever question that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that kind of runs through my mind when I'm wrestling with those moments, those high intensity moments, is I wouldn't say all the time. I would say occasionally this runs through my mind and it changes the dynamic completely. And it doesn't run through my mind word for word, but it's the verse about the mindset on the spirit is life and peace, but the mindset on the flesh is death. I think I said it backwards. I think it says the death one first, but the mindset on the flesh is death. And what I take that to mean is that if you get focused in Romans, where he says that in Romans 8, he has been talking about, like previously, he's been talking about like an attempt to kind of have a flesh powered law oriented approach, you know, in Romans 7, he's wrestling with that. He's like, man, I want to do good, but I'm just, you know, I'm coming from this law background kind of thing. And I keep doing what I don't want to do. And it feels to me like the key that he's saying is like, it's in the mind, it's in your mindset that changes how you are going to act, how you transform into something that's, you know, that's more godly. And law, actually, if you focus on the law, that's actually a fleshly approach. You know, this is my take on it anyway. Maybe others have a different opinion, but my take on it is what he's saying is like, if you focus on the flesh, which is following the law and making sure you're doing everything right, you're dotting the I's and crossing the T's, you're giving it the full, you know, the full effort to follow the rules, even in parenting, it leads to death, it leads to destruction, it leads to failure.
Yeah.
What the success is where you set your mind. When you set your mind on the spirit, Colossians says it different. Says set your mind on things above. Various other verses talk about this idea, but in that moment when I'm like super, super, I'll use your word, Sean, exasperated with the kids, if I will stop for just a second and internally say something about that to myself, like what's God's perspective on this situation, or like, what is the spiritual angle here? Or how would God, Dane, you actually said something kind of like it. Like, how does God treat me when I'm acting like this? I mean, that's an example of setting your mind on the spiritual, you know, in that moment. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything. I mean, it doesn't mean that I can automatically control what my kid's doing, because I think that's what the flesh wants to do. The flesh wants to control the child by frightening them into submission or something like that. That's fleshly. But if I could set my mind on the spiritual perspective, in that moment, pretty often a surprising result will come about. The response is usually more creative. It's more constructive. It's more gentle. Which makes me think of this verse that I wrote down to kind of counter that legalism idea. Let's see, where is it? Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Ephesians 4:32. Or this one, Proverbs 15:1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It's like that gentleness. Remember, gentleness is a fruit of the Spirit. So to get access to that, you got to turn to the Spirit, you know. You got to turn your mind toward God. You got to put yourself in that place and open yourself up to God working through the situation. And I think the way you do that is like what Dane was saying, or like what I'm saying here is like you put your mind on God. You put your mind on that, you know, those higher things,
and it can radically transform the situation. Now, the challenge is it's momentary, it's temporal. And the next time it comes up, if you don't do it then you'll probably have a fleshly interaction. You'll have, some kind of situation like that. So each time we're practicing, hopefully we're practicing getting better at that, and kind of putting our mind in the right spot. Because that's the thing we can control. We actually can't control our children. God gave them free will. And that's maybe kind of a misnomer. It's like a lot of people will talk about, is what they do based on nurture or nature? And that's a false dichotomy, because there's a third aspect. The third aspect is that kid can do whatever he wants and accept the consequences. So he has agency. He can do what he wants.
Yeah. I think of it this way. I mean, I believe in free will. I believe in deep human agency, as they say. Nature and nurture are both influences, but neither of them are causes. Ultimately the kid chooses for himself or herself. But on that note, here's also a different component of parenting. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but I think this is also part of a grace perspective. There's one of the verses you shared with us was Exodus 20:12 from the Ten Commandments. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. And another one was Hebrews 12:11. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who've been trained by it. And one of the things that I'm trying to tell my kids is, I conceptualize it this way. There is room for what I call godly self-interest. And I tell this to my congregation. God's way is good for you. God's way leads to better outcomes than when you rebel against God's way. And there's all kinds of promises like this in Scripture, that it's not selfish in the sense that I'm going to do what I want no matter what God says or what anyone else says. That's selfishness. This is godly self-interest. God wants what's best for us. I want what's best for my children, but God can't make me choose, and I can't make them choose. But here are reasons why you should choose that way. And I think God gives us reasons to live in the way that he has designed us to live, because generally speaking, it leads to more fulfilling lives, more stable families, more loving relationships, and all this stability. And I try to give that to my kids, and I kind of try to point out to them, look at the friends around you, or look at the people around you, and look at the outcome of their lives for having made these decisions. Please do not make those decisions. In my family background, there's a lot of atheism and secularism, and that led to a lot of drug use, a lot of jail time, a lot of rehab time, a lot of divorce, and just all kinds of destruction in my extended family. And I point my kids to that, and I say, do you see the difference that our family is? That we love each other. We're together. Your mother and I, we love each other. So-and-so doesn't know who his dad is, or so-and-so hasn't seen his parents or her parents in so long. But do you see, we're following God's way, and it's good for us to follow God's way. And so that's kind of another level of parenting that I'm finding, and also pastoring, just promoting godly self-interest. God's way is better for you.
Yeah. Well, and so the fruit of the Spirit are all things that you want, the way that I'm thinking of it is like, we want to produce the fruit of the Spirit in our kids' life, but it's not the fruit of the parents. And it would have been called that if that's what it was. It's the fruit of the Spirit. The Spirit has to do that. And legalism, this is one of the challenges of like, I'll call it like extreme parenting, where you're like all up in all everything they do. Legalism cannot produce the fruit of the Spirit. They have to take it and run with it. They have to build that relationship with the Lord themselves. And some boundaries, some discipline mixed with grace, I think sets them up for that. But they do have to choose it. You know, they do have to chase it themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's a challenge because we want to ensure, you know, and that's we grab onto those verses like in Proverbs as if they're a surety that if you do this, here is the outcome. But you're dealing with another human who yes. has the ability to make decisions, and that you just can't remove that.
No. And like,
you
just
know,
think
because
of
even
your...
God won't remove, even God doesn't remove it, you know?
No, he like, allows yeah. it. Like, think of our marriages. Like when I point to my kids to, you know, how Abby and I were happy together. It's not a struggle free life, but we're happy together. But why is that? It's because both Abby and I are choosing to follow God's way. And if Abby chose against God's way, or if I did, then we wouldn't have a happy marriage. It requires two people freely choosing to surrender to the Lord and to live according to his way. And it's mm-hmm. like, I hope my kids, I always tell my kids, the second most important decision you'll ever make after believing in Jesus is choosing who you are going to marry. Cause that yeah. will just have so many consequences mm-hmm. for the rest of your life.
Yeah. That brings up a subject I don't really want to talk about, but I do feel like it's probably worth at least mentioning. We are raising kids in the epitome of a sexualized culture. The ancient mm-hmm. world had it too. It seemed like it was suppressed for a while after kind of the Puritan movement. And so it's not like it's brand new, but it is kind of new for this generation, because the last generation was a bit more suppressed, it seems like, in yeah. some of these areas. So how do we deal with that? I mean, everything from homosexuality to transgender to, you know, all of these hot topics, it deeply affects how we parent and how we talk to our kids about those choices that they make. And it's frightening to think that they have agency. They have their own choices to make in this process. So, like, how are you guys dealing with that? Dane, I'm wondering if that's touched you guys at all yet. I'm thinking maybe not because of the ages, but like, how are you planning for that if you haven't talked about it yet?
You mean Dane yeah. isn't talking to his 4-year-old about the transgender movement? What?
That's what I read to them before bed every night. No. I mean, the thing that this is where I think talking about what we've been talking about, like what Sean mentioned, how like the godly self interest comes into play. Yeah. And the first thing, like the first verse on the list that you sent us is that Proverbs 22:6, like, start a child on the way he should go, and even when he's old, he will not turn from it. That principle of like, okay, while they're young, instill in them, like, train them up in like, this is what God says. This is how he made us. This is what his desires are. This is what, this was how we were designed to live. And I think that the more our kids are, and the sooner that they are, you know, taught that and kind of like are able to, as they're growing up, like that they'll see different people, experiencing different things. And that opens up curiosity and questions about like, why is this happening or like this? And an example of this is Katie and I, we try to teach our kids to be, you know, we ought to be like grateful and thankful for the things that we have, not always wanting more and stuff, because some people don't have like these things that we have. Example, like we're talking to a 3-year-old. So like, we should be like, you know, we're thankful for, you know, our toys that we have, because not every kid has toys. And she's like, they don't. I'm like, oh, not everybody does. And then she starts asking questions like, do they have a bed? I'm like, some don't. I'm like, do they have a pillow? I'm like, well, some don't. Like, what about home? I'm like, there's some people that don't have that as well. And so we should be like God, like Jesus, who is, you know, trying to be kind to those people and helping them, because they don't have all the things that we have. And that's why we should, you know, be considerate and thinking and praying for people like that. And so like they're thinking along those connecting dots about the way other people experience life. And if we're teaching them, God's way in a, like quote unquote, how we were designed to live and what God promises comes along with living in sync with design, they can start to see like, the pitfalls of lifestyles, kind of like Sean was talking about earlier as well, that go from living contrary to that and stuff. And obviously like the homosexuality or transgender thing hasn't like come up, but the thing that we want, I guess how I would explain it at some point was like, well, God loves all of those people as well. But God is not always like pleased with, the choices that we make or the things that we buy into that actually harm us in the long run. And, and so like, and I guess that's how I would approach it, because a lot of people get the wrong idea that God like hates homosexuals or like that, or the lie that like, you know, like this is an inherent thing that like we're born into and like it's who they are type of thing. I think when people believe that it's who they are, then by saying that it's not right, you're saying that I'm not right. Like I am like at the molecular level have been designed poorly and badly and God doesn't love me because of that. And that's all just mixed up. And so I think just training them and showing them how God created us, what he thinks of us, what he desires for us, all of that shapes the other things that come up later. And we just reinforce the, it's just like the mommy and daddy love you no matter what.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we're always like happy, with the things you decide to do. Partly because we know that some of the things that you choose to do, like as a 3-year-old, are not good for you. Like having candy and chocolate before you know, we even have breakfast. No, watching a bunch of TV, no, it's going to fry your brain and you're going to be cranky all day and all this kind of stuff. So it's like, that's like the baby elementary level of like what we as adults, as we grow up, like we still do the same things, but on a magnified level that has more consequences. And, and if we're not taught or shown like those things ahead of time, it's hard for us to have a chance at like, you know, making choices that have a God, best interest in mind type of, outcome.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Sean, you're farther down the line than both of us. I mean, like, have you guys been wrestling with it at all? How do y'all deal with it?
Yeah. Cause it's in the schools. It's the middle schoolers in church. It just comes up because it's in the culture. I was talking to one of our middle schoolers and she just wanted prayer for her friend, and I want to be careful here. I don't want to use names. Let's just say, I'm just going to make up names here. She's like, I want prayer for my friend, David. He doesn't use his dead name anymore. So we're just going to call him David. And I was like, dead name? What are you talking about? She's like, well, David used to be Lucy, but that's Lucy's his dead name. So it's just David. And he's, you know, that wasn't the subject of prayer. The subject of prayer was something else related to David, but the whole basically transgenderism of David was totally normal. That was just on the table. That was just reality for this middle schooler. And I was like, oh my goodness, is that the point that we've come to? So for me, in fact, I just told this to the executive director of our Baptist Association here. He asked me, like, how can the association be helping you? And I said, listen, there is this there's this tidal wave of this stuff, confusion over sexuality and gender and all that stuff. And I feel like this is almost the number 2 thing that I'm concerned about as a pastor. My number 1 thing always is salvation by grace and discipleship by grace. But my second mm-hmm. thing is we got to talk about sexual ethics, and because our kids do not know, and we do not have strong families and strong marriages in the church. We have some, but man, we gotta work on that, because otherwise we're gonna lose our kids. And so when it comes to transgenderism, I mean, I've thought about these issues a lot. I believe in what's called the theology of the body, and people can look that up. But it's basically saying your body tells you who you are, and God gave you this body, and that's who you are, and that's good. That's a good way to be. And it doesn't really matter how you feel. You might feel like, oh, I like this kind of thing or like that kind of thing, but your feelings change, but your body is objective. It tells you who you are objectively. And, but it comes back down to, like, I found myself telling my kids, but also the when I say my kids, not just my immediate kids, but the kids in the church, it's like, at the end of the day, Jesus is my king, and I follow his way, and I don't follow the world's way. And sometimes it just kind of comes down to a black and white decision like that. Jesus is my king, and I don't, the world has a different king.
Yeah. Yeah. And we trust mm-hmm. him. We trust that whether we can explain it or not, you know, mm-hmm. we're with him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we chose to be in public school with our kids, and but most of our friends are homeschooled, and so like most of our church families are homeschooled, and it has occurred to me that we're on a different timeline for information that needs to be disseminated to the kids. So Ailey, our oldest, it was first grade. Early in the year when we needed to have an explanation of why one of her friends at school had two moms, you know.
Yeah.
And you got to back up from that. You got to back up to, like, what's normal, you know. And, of course, we did it in a kid-friendly way. But, I mean, like, for me, it's like, get a pencil. We're going to draw diagrams and, you know, of how families work and how God designed people and stuff like that. And so I didn't really expect to be doing that in first grade, but mm-hmm. but my theory has been, I want to be ridiculously open to questions without laughter or without chagrin or without shame, because mm-hmm. when the stakes raise and the consequences are high, I want them to remember, hey, daddy's open for any question. You know, it doesn't bother him. You know, it can be about rocket ships, or it could be about reproductive organs. You know, it's like anything is on the table, and you don't get laughed at or you don't get shamed for asking. And so so my goal at this age is to make a really open forum for him to approach. And that's just trying to sow the seed of openness later so that we can continue to guide. And so with each of them, and some people say, you know, you need to have the sex talk. I think that's wrong, because you don't have one sex talk. You need to be mm-hmm. talking about family structure throughout their lives. And it needs to be kid friendly when they're young, and it needs to advance in complexity. But I had kind of imagined we would go and get private, you know, get alone with one of them at a time. But I've actually found for us, I prefer to just talk about it openly, even sometimes around the dinner table or whatever, so that the younger ones can hear us conversing about it in a non-threatening way. This is just part of life. And, we just talk about it. And there's people that choose to do it not God's way, but you know, there's huge advantages to doing it God's way, and it pleases God. And so, hey, I'm just seeing we're above an hour now. So I think maybe we kind of wrap up. I'll give you my final thoughts for this. And it's something that happened. So you guys can think of your final thoughts as I'm telling this. So the other day, something interesting kind of happened. So I've noticed that my relationship with my parents,
my parents are really smart and very, you know, very active. And, but I've noticed a shift in the relationship, and the shift in the relationship is they place at least some, I might would say a quarter to a half of their decision making on what their kids think, my brothers included. I've noticed it over the last few years, but like we're no longer in the phase where they're the ones that know everything and they make their decisions independent of us. They now call and say, what do you think? You know, and it's an interesting transition. My mom called the other day and she's helping one of her neighbors who is, you know, a little bit elderly. And she had this kind of complicated situation with her neighbor's eyesight. It's not so great, but she still wants to drive. And so mom's trying to help her navigate through that. So she called me and at about midway through the conversation, I realized, oh, she's wanting my advice. She wants to know what I think she ought to do, you know?
Yeah.
And so we talked it out and together, it wasn't like, I know, I was just like, well, I don't know, but we talked it out. And by the end of the conversation, she said, I'm glad we talked. That's what I'll do. You know, she took the advice and she went and did it. And that made me think about someday my kids are going to be in that situation. And that in a sense, that's a trajectory to aim for, you know, that's like a target to point at. And so I thought, yeah, I'm going to tell the kids that because they probably haven't thought of that. And so I explained that someday our relationship is going to change and I'm going to stop telling you what to do. That's early. And then a little bit later, I'm going to start asking you what you think I should do. I'm going to ask you for advice because you're going to be more connected to what's going on in the world. You're going to be probably better with technology, whatever it is, you know? And so, and they just kind of were surprised by it to hear that I'm going to be giving you advice. But the point of telling them that was, so to like today and these days when you're young, I'm raising you for that as that being part of the purpose is you being someone I can come to for advice, you know, and if you follow God's plan, if you become a person that cares about God's word, if you become a person that wants to please the Lord, I will absolutely seek advice from you. You know, it's the nature of it. But the part I didn't tell them, and I think will be, you know, kind of a future conversation is if you kind of like move away from the Lord or if you start running from the Lord, our relationship won't be that. I will always love you. I will always cherish you. But that advice relationship where we, you know, where we have a meeting of the minds, that comes from, you know, living a similar life and making similar choices and wanting similar things. You know, my parents want to please the Lord just, you know, and I do too. And so we have this incredible harmony in that. Had I gone a different way, that we wouldn't have that relationship. And the relationship is what's so valuable. It's so rewarding. I see it both ways. I see it from the grandparent and parent perspective, but I also see it from the kid perspective. It's rewarding up and down in both directions, you know, to have that kind of relationship and to grow into the point where we're really friends, you know? And so it's like I'm producing when I'm raising my kids to be my friend, you know, to be my a very close ally as they grow. And they have their own choice in that. They can decide if that's who they want to be, but it's a really beautiful kind of generational image to me to kind of paint that for them and let them see that that's where we're hopefully heading with all of this. And so when we're disciplining and you don't understand, or hopefully when we're showing grace in disciplining, that's what we're aiming for, is we're aiming for those days when it's, you know, when it's like that. So I'm seeing that my final words took nearly 5 minutes and 48 seconds. So sorry about that. But that's my kind of final thought. What about you guys? What's your final thoughts on the subject?
I'm willing to let you have that final thought.
And that's it. That's all you got. Okay.
Yeah. Well, how do you say, I appreciate you guys. Y'all are farther along in the parenthood than Katie and I. So, it was nice to hear y'all's perspective as well. It's helpful for me to take that in from like-minded believers and to be thinking about how Katie and I could implement those things as well. So I appreciate the conversation.
That's nice of you to say. I suspect, though, Dane, that you may be farther along than I was when I was at the phase you're in, because I don't know, to hear you saying like the really positive things you're saying with the kids as young as they are, I kind of feel like I stumbled around a bit. Sean, did you feel that way too? Or, I mean, like, were you where Dane is at that age, or did it take a while to kind of get your feet under you?
Oh yeah. Are my feet under me now? Is that
real? Maybe that's the real question. Yeah. Maybe that's just what this life of raising humans is we always feel like we're a little out of balance. I don't know, but it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we're trying to do it God's way, and time will tell. But it's very rewarding.
I mean, what's under me, my feet now is a bunch of cat barf. So I'm going to go. I'm going to go finish cleaning that up, because that was.
Did you leave it sitting there this whole time?
Is it? No, still I know. I literally, and I'm not. This isn't even for the story. It's true. I noticed there are still chunks in the hallway because Zane did a sloppy job. So I'm going to have to go do that after this.
It's cemented to the ground now.
It's hard. Calcified. Yep. Okay. Well, hey, we better let Sean go and clean the hallway. Thank you, guys. This was a good conversation. And our next podcast, I was hoping to do something somewhat related, but we'll wait to tell you what that is until then. So thanks for listening, and we will talk to you guys later on.